sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
It's a big week for markets. The fiscal cliff averted, but maybe not so fast. Earnings season is dead ahead already with Alcoa coming out. And we have this and much more to talk about on episode number 295 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And thanks again for joining me. This is Andrew Horowitz. And again, I am so happy to have you here in the glorious 2013 year. We're going on, let's see, we have 295 episodes, and if we do one a week, we're going on about, 5 years or so now of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, and it's been a great run. I think we've only missed about two actual weeks along the way, so that's pretty good. That's a good good statistic, and you've been there right along as well, and welcome to any of the new listeners that we have starting off a great year where we're going to bring to you some wonderful guests and some great opportunities for hopefully learning a bit about investing and maybe even a couple of ideas or two to help you along your way on making some profits and becoming a disciplined investor yourself. All right, let's talk about what's going on. There is a whole, just a slew of things that are happening right now that you need to be aware of, and some things that probably you want to just turn away from and not even think about because, you know, it's getting a little bit rough to be watching the shenanigans that we're seeing in government. But we did see a big week in the markets, and a lot of that had to do with maybe two or three different components. Clearly, the relief that there was some decision made in the fiscal cliff discussion, although it was not a, I don't think it was really the end of all of this, but it is at least some of the questionable and uncertainty that was surrounding the idea of, hey, are taxes going up? Are they not going up? Who's it going up for? What are we going to do about spending? Some of that has been at least put to rest for a little while. Not forever, because, what is it, February, March? We're going to start this all up again because the Republicans have said that they're going to, you know, they're okay to be losing the fight, but the battle is ahead when they talk about the next generation, the next level of this fiscal cliff drama, which is going to be the debt ceiling. And in the debt ceiling discussions, they're going to use their power to hold off any kind of resolution to that with some spending cuts. And already we know about $300 billion that they were trying to push in at the last minute, but of course they couldn't because there would be indecision and no ability to make any headway. And of course they wouldn't do it prior to the markets opening and the futures opening because that would just be devastating, of course. So that's the first thing that helped the markets during the week. The second thing that helped the markets, really, if you think about it, it was the new year. It was the fact that when that happens, there's a lot of reallocation of assets from one place to another. And this year, we've seen a little bit of a move from bonds into stocks. And that was helped by the Fed, who, you know, talked about how, you know, if the economy gets better, they'll continue to do so. But there are some limitations possibly to the quantitative easing, to the bond purchasing program that they've been doing. Now, what was interesting, I thought, was that you had all these Fed heads out throughout the week talking about how, you know, on one hand, they need to continue with their various economy or economic benefits and boosting and stimulus. At the same time, it looks like some of them don't know what they're talking about, because they're talking about how, well, you know, this year or that year, we could stop doing this or stop doing that. But at the end of the day, we already heard that the decision had been made that it would have to be a certain unemployment rate and a certain economic benchmark to get to before they would stop doing so. The only one that came out with anything that seemed realistic and on par with what was already discussed and agreed to was Bullard. He came out and said, well, what is this talk about time frames and all that? The fact is that we're looking at some very specific measures, and that's when we're going to stop with the bond purchase, et cetera. Well, at first, with some of the talk that went back and forth and the miscommunication once again, maybe on purpose, maybe to, you know, to do a little bit of confusion and misdirection, bond markets sold off and money was reallocated into equities. Again, from a year-end, year-beginning standpoint, as well as the fact that there was some confusion about what was going on with the purchases by the Fed and the continuation of their quantitative easing programs. And a third thing that probably helped markets last week was the fact that there was some better-than-expected economic numbers out of China, and that is good because they have really been suffering for the last, I don't know, year or so with subpar manufacturing numbers. Their actual ISM non-manufacturing or the service industry had been doing pretty well for a while. But what we saw was that we continued to see the non-manufacturing, the services sector, do well, but the manufacturing levels, they picked up nicely. So that was good to see also. Now, in Japan, we saw just a rocket ship of a market over the last, 4 or 5 weeks. And that's primarily due to the fact that we're finally seeing the government get very serious about not only their rhetoric, but of their actually doing something to push their currency down. The currency has been in a 20-year, well, depends on how you look at it, but it's been in rising in value against the dollar for the last 20 years or so. Some 300%, in fact. And that's creating a major problem for their exporters. No question about that, right? You think about if our currency rose 300% against other countries, what would that do to our exports? I mean, it would stop them dead in their tracks. Or what it would do, maybe not stop them dead, but we'd have to do something to cut the margins down and reduce the cost to try to unload some of the stuff. Now, one of the fascinating things that's happening in Japan is what they have done is some of their manufacturing, particularly of cars and some electronics, have been taking place in other places outside of Japan because they have found that because of their currency valuation problem, that it's actually much more effective to go outside of Japan and manufacture and deliver direct from there. As a matter of fact, they're delivering cars from the U.S. to Japan. They're exporting from the U.S. In other words, they're building off-site, off the Japanese, out of the country. Then they're exporting it from the U.S. to Japan for importation to their current citizens and consumers. I mean, think about that. That's a real problem when it comes to the situation with their currency. Now, of course, we're not going to call them a currency manipulator because the only one that we could do so is maybe Russia, maybe some third world countries, and of course, China. We have them in our crosshairs at all times. But this government is not going to say anything about the fact that Japan is directly going after the currency. And in fact, they do invest directly in their equity markets as well. And if that's not manipulation, I don't know what is. Now, we got some great comments about last week's guest, Larry Williams. Hopefully you listened to that episode number 294. And we talked about commodities. We talked about some of the things that he was thinking about for the next year, his outlook. And this was all pre-fiscal cliff decision. But I think that he has some very good lessons. I mean, he is a gentleman who has been in the markets for decades and decades and has seen a lot of different scenarios and different economic conditions and different earning scenarios and different things that happen around the world that affect commodities prices, whether it's soft goods or, you know, food goods or energy goods, et cetera, or maybe even metals. Next week, we have Amy Smith with Investors Business Daily. She wrote a book that I think is going to be very interesting to talk about. And she is a great guest to have on. Investors Business Daily is one of those great resources that if you're just looking for investment news, you know, the difference between that and, let's say, the Wall Street Journal is just, you know, packed with many different things and travel and leisure and world news and all that. Well, the Investors Business Daily is kind of like focuses in on the investing side only. So I want to talk about the VIX in a moment and also some of the earnings that we have coming up. Before we do, though, I want to mention GoToMeeting. And we've talked about this, and I really hope you've taken advantage of this. But if you haven't done so, there's a free offer by GoToMeeting by Citrix that gives you 30 days of free access to GoToMeeting. And you can use it in any way you see fit. And whether you want to use it for meetings or just family reunions or you want to just do some kind of sharing and collaboration, whatever it is, GoToMeeting has a great platform that is so easy to use. And it's not only user-friendly, but it's also user-friendly for those people who you invite to the meeting. So it's not a lot of, you know, kind of wondering how to use this program and, you know, what do I do here? But basically, you are able to share your desktop, share files, collaborate. You can use their HD faces, which is a way to actually have a meeting where you see the other person as well, and they can show you things. So that's great for family. That's great for eye-to-eye contact when you're dealing with in a sales situation. And again, it's available for iPod and every platform, whether it's Apple iOS or the OS Mac OS, or whether it's Windows. All of that's available, and you can get it for free for 30 days. That's right, 30 days. So go to GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and be sure to use the promo code PODCAST. That's GoToMeeting.com. So next week, in terms of economics, it's a light week, and this usually happens when we have the first week of earnings come out. Now, it's not a coincidence or anything like that. It's just the way it is. You know, it's early on in the quarter, and we're starting to see the beginnings of the earnings that come out. Economics are usually backloaded towards the end, as we know, when it comes to, much of the numbers, so they can actually gather the previous month's information. We did see a better-than-expected number on ISM, although a few of the other factory numbers didn't come out that great. The unemployment rate did tick up to 7.8% last week in the U.S., and the number that came in for new hires at 155 was lower than expectations. So the one thing that I thought was really interesting is the whole idea of this Superstorm Sandy and the lower confidence from consumer confidence that came across over the last couple of months is not really showing up in the payrolls numbers. And I find that really interesting. And I find that, I don't know if it's hard to believe, but I just find it odd. Because you would think that there's about a one-month lag and a correlation between a lower consumer confidence number and also with the higher inventory levels, lower manufacturing that's going to come from that, lower sales numbers, and the Superstorm Sandy, you would have thought that there'd be a much bigger number in terms of the unemployment rate potentially, or at least a much lower rate in terms of the people that were recently hired. But that hasn't come yet, and I'm not sure if it's going to. It's very hard to predict because these numbers have been a little bit squishy lately and confusing. For example, the unemployment rate going down to 7.7 recently, right before the election, and holding there for a month and starting to creep back up a little bit. It's kind of, like I said, a little strange and a little odd. The labor participation rate is doing a little bit to help those numbers. But at the same time, we're hearing that there's a lot less hiring inside some of the core reports that we're seeing. So where they're coming from and where this is all happening and whether we're going to see revisions that will be substantial in the next couple of months remains to be seen. But right now, there is that happening. And next week, we have a very limited amount of information coming out. We do have some inventory numbers that are coming out that I think will be very important to look at, because if you look at the inventory to sales numbers recently, you're seeing a build. You're seeing a growth in the inventory to sales ratio. Now, what that means is you take the inventories and divide it by the sales. Okay, so inventory to sales ratio, or ratioing it, which is always a division versus a spread, which is a subtraction. So the inventory to sales ratio, it has been growing, which means that inventories are outpacing sales. Now, one of two things is happening there. Either manufacturers are feeling really bullish and they're, on the wholesale side, and they think that, they're going to get a lot of orders, or orders are coming down or sales are coming down. A few different possible scenarios that are happening here. Well, we already know that the big sales season, the Black Friday through the end of the year and the holiday sales have been a little bit lower than anticipated across the board. There are pockets of companies that have done a lot better, but across the board in general, we're seeing there's a little bit of weakness that's going on there. The second thing is that we already also see that the inventory builds are going to probably slow down the manufacturing, and that's why I get back to my discussion on the employment situation, how it's holding up so well in the face of some of this. So we're going to see that. We're also going to see the import numbers and in terms of price, import prices. Now, this is interesting because last month we saw a drop of about 1% in import prices, which helps out manufacturers in terms of their net margin. Think about that. If they have the same production going on, or less even, or more, but yet they have a drop in the cost of the products that they have that they're importing to use in their manufacturing process, that's good for their net margins. Keep the prices the same, don't drop their prices, and that's good. It's also good for retailers. Potentially, they can possibly get a better bargain on some of the things that they're looking to purchase. But at the same time, that concern over dropping prices, you know, has to kind of wake up Bernanke and his gang to the fact that, you know, the CPI number is still pretty low and we're not seeing any core inflation, no increase in PPI to speak of that's really significant, and that deflationary feel is still in the air. Now, as long as that is present, you're not going to see a lot of concern by the Fed over, you know, continuing all sorts of extraneous and beyond normal measures to try to pump up the economy. Now, hopefully, if we come to some kind of fiscal resolution that makes sense, where we can balance the budget and maybe, you know, cut the debt a bit, which I'm not hoping for. Well, I'm hoping for, but I'm not hopeful for. You know, maybe the Fed will back off a little bit because they really have stretched their what they are comfortable with and stretched their balance sheet pretty significantly over the last couple of years. And they've said several times that they're really not comfortable with that they're really doing that in the place of any sound fiscal policy by the government. So, you know, we're going to have to watch what happens there. Now, when it comes to earnings, it is the official start of earnings season next week. And you know what that means? That means that Alcoa will be kicking it off. And that's happening after hours on the 8th. And we're going to see Monsanto that day, Apollo Group, Global Payments, aftermarket. Monsanto will come up pre-market, actually. But on the 8th, we have Alcoa. Now, if you look at what analysts are expecting, over the last 4 weeks, they've dropped their EPS and their revenue numbers. They dropped their EPS numbers by about 30% for the quarter. 30%! Now, wait a minute. Just weeks before the earnings are coming out, they dropped their expectations by 30% on EPS and 20% on earnings, on revenue. That's significant. So is this a sign that they are concerned that they won't make their numbers, or nothing more than the company and the analysts massaging their numbers so they can beat and look better? Alcoa already is doing what they always do. They're just, you know, kind of stock is moving up into earnings. We've seen that many times before, many quarters before, only to initially do better by beating, and then the reality sets in that, you know, these numbers really weren't so good, and stock kind of comes in again. Now, will this quarter be any different? It's possible. There is a little bit more demand for their products, but I am very interested in why analysts on average, and this is a well-covered company, why they dropped their earnings down so dramatically over the last several weeks. Again, if I was to guess, it's because the closer we're getting, the more massaging that's going on. But at the same time, even with a drop of 30% of estimates, the stock has been kind of slowly creeping higher. And whether that's just because markets have been creeping higher and hit a multi-year high on Friday or what the story is, it's hard to really understand what's going on there. But we're also going to see Texas Industries, Greenbrier, let's see who else we have, and Wells Fargo at the end of the week. The first of the banks to report. Last week we saw what we usually see is right before earnings season, Goldman Sachs, about a week or two before, comes out with a big old upgrade of somebody. Well, this time they did it with Citigroup. They came out with I believe a buy, and they put them on their, you know, hooty-tooty list of some sort, whether it's their conviction list or whatever they're calling it these days. And what I always think about is when Goldman does an upgrade of a bank right before earnings season, I always think that, you know, they can't upgrade themselves, so why not upgrade one of their nearest competitors to give it a sign that, hey, we think that we're going to do very well and beat, and you really should be buying the whole industry, et cetera. Because don't forget, the big, you know, the groundswell of banks moving in one direction helps out Goldman pretty well. And what we've seen over the last several months has been that banks have been back in favor. This is something that we talked about on one of our recent shows, that, you know, banks have been out of favor the year before, and home builders were out of favor, and some of the less favorable companies have been really making some unbelievable strides in 2012. And the question is whether we're going to see a reversal of that, and some of the companies that were really out of favor, like steel companies and maybe some of the for-profit educational companies, maybe even some of the technology companies like Hewlett-Packard, would all of a sudden see a dramatic reversal and a realization that they had to do something to fix things, and, you know, if the stock has been just so demolished over the last number of years, you know, do something and that will be a big turnaround. Because, you know, at the end of the day, companies are looking to grow. Companies are looking to better themselves. Companies are always looking to earn profits. It's not like they're out there specifically looking to, you know, do themselves harm. So you have to kind of sometimes give the benefit of the doubt that, you know, over time, many of these companies, the better companies, are going to actually find a way to fix their problem. Because if they don't, they're just going to, you know, go bankrupt. No, nobody's going to be talking about them or buying them. But these are things that you need to consider right now, because we talked about Hewlett-Packard about, I think, 2 weeks ago. I believe it was 2 weeks ago. And the stock has done extremely well. They're going to be selling some of their business components that aren't profitable. They're looking to really get all the news out that's a problem and kind of purge all the negativity. And there was such a severe amount of negative sentiment with the company that I said that, you know, it almost seems like there's only one way to go at this point. You know, you could see a little bit of a retest here, but at the same time, it looks like there's a great opportunity to see some upward movement in Hewlett-Packard. Hopefully you got in on that, because that was a good timing on that, and it really has paid off very nicely so far. We'll see where it goes from here. Has a little ways to go before it's really convincingly a breakout of any sort. But at the same time, it is at least going in the right direction for now. And that's one of the things that I want you to key into. The idea that a stock can be a loser for a while, but, you know, there is sometimes management changes, changes of business direction, changes of investment environment and economic environment that may actually benefit a company. And again, just look no further than the home builders over the last year. At the same time, you have to also realize that the opposite is true as well, okay? So this is important. You know, you can't think that the environment is always going to stay the same for a company. Thesis change, products change, other companies come into competition. And again, here's one not to think anything further than just looking at Apple. So Apple, for no really apparent reason, dropped from the 700s down to the 500s, and really get no traction from there. Every time you think that there's going to be a little bit of traction from Apple, it just kind of falls back. It was down over 2.5%, I believe it was, on Friday, after a few days doing nicely, and dragged the NASDAQ down with it. So when you're looking at the environment, you're looking at a stock, realize that there are different times, seasonalities, different economic environments, and points of the trough to recovery, stabilization, back into trough over time. You know, these are cycles that happen, and something you need to pay attention to, and I want you to do so. There are other things that happen too, like news. For example, look at Herbalife recently, symbol HLF. Now, this stock was under some scrutiny for a while, ever since about a year ago, when during a conference call, David Einhorn, a hedge fund manager, came out and asked a couple of simple questions about revenue recognition, etc. And the stock dropped just dramatically from there. And one of the things that we saw recently was that Ackman, who is another hedge fund manager, was actively involved. He's an activist, but he's actively involved in coming at this company and saying pretty much it's a fraud. Just saying outright it's a fraud, even building a website, saying he's 20 million shares short. I mean, that's a pretty big statement, being 20 million shares short of this company. And the stock dropped another a whole bunch. Well, the stock then recovered, bounced off the bottom. You could have caught that for about 10% or 12%, maybe even more, maybe a 15% return over a few days. And now the question is, where do we go from here? Because what happened is that there's nothing really changed at all from the company, besides the fact that we have two separate activists. There's Ackman on one side, who is saying that the company's a fraud, has a website dedicated to it, huge short position, etc. And on the other side, there's another hedge fund manager, which name escapes me, who is saying, hey, wait a minute, this is actually a great company, and you're going to be very surprised at what they can do. So we're going to see this push and pull and this kind of opportunity to go long and short, I think, this stock for a while. I was a little bit surprised at how far it shot up last week. It came up right through a small resistance point and then kind of kept on going higher. And every time that it bounced down, there seemed to be a buyer that was buying the shares. I would watch this stock very closely. It's a very fast mover. Intraday, it can move up and down, you know, 5% easily in either direction at any given time. So just keep a watch on that and see what happens. So we talked about HPQ, Hewlett-Packard, U.S. Steel we talked about in the steel sector. So those are things you need to kind of keep an eye on right now. Maybe look at the home builders with a different eye and consider all the things that are happening in the world right now and maybe where some of the increasing interest rates will be detrimental to companies and where the cycle of the return to at least stabilization and maybe some growth in China will benefit others. Now, if you weren't watching last week, the VIX had a very bad week. Poor thing. After being up into the fiscal cliff situation, you know what happened? I mean, it was up at, I think it was 22. It kind of kept on popping off of 15 to 18, 15 to 18, and then it kind of shot up to 22 right before the fiscal cliff announcement. And then last week had one of the worst weeks it's had in, when I say a long time, I mean a long time. The VIX dropped about 40% last week, down sub 14. The idea is that with the news about the fiscal cliff, that it's behind us now, China getting a little bit better, beginning of the year, seasonality, blah, blah, blah. Well, there's going to be much lower volatility. But I also think what happened was, you know, these things tend to overshoot in either direction. And probably what happened was that there's a lot of people loading up in the idea that, hey, this fiscal cliff thing isn't going to get solved before the new year, and it's going to run over significantly. There's going to be a big battle. Markets are going to get just, you know, big trouble. Let's buy some insurance. And they were buying it at some, you know, prices that are probably were above levels that they should have bought it at. On the other hand, now that things seem to be settling out, those people, the excess people that bought into it, are thinking, hey, wait a minute, I don't need this anymore. At least I was buying it temporarily. Let me get out of it. And what happens is they all run to the exits at the same time. So the VIX, you know, comes under 14 and now is skewed too far to the other side. So what do you do? Well, it could be a very good time to actually pick up some VIX options, maybe long-term through the end of March, maybe April, because we know that we're on par for another, you know, showdown of some sort. It may not be, well, it probably will be a little bit more extended than we saw here because they have more time to, you know, really ramp the rhetoric at this point, and they have a little bit more of a wedge to use, which this, you know, the budget, the debt ceiling to use in order to try to prod something out of the Democrats, at least. I mean, that's kind of how it's being shaped at this point. So, it may be an interesting time to think about buying some very cheap insurance and looking at that, but buying it over a period of time, you know, buying it into March or April, I would say, would be the best way to look at it. Of course, with options, the longer that you go, the more it costs for time value. So there's something built in there. So look at the 17 and a halves, which is kind of the level that seems to be the level that has been a lot of times, moving up to. Look at the 17 and a half, look at the 20s. And the 20s will probably be a lot cheaper at this point than they were just a few days ago. And look at those as possibly some things to buy as an investment at this point to help with some of the potential volatility after a lot of people sold at just any price moving into after or post the fiscal cliff situation. So the VIX is definitely something. We talked about the VIX, different products, a few shows back, with our guy from S&P, and we talked about how some of these things just don't work, mainly the VIX ETFs that are doubles and inverse and synthetic. You got to kind of stick to, if you're going to use those, a very short-term time period. You can't use those, you know, really long term. They just degrade naturally because of just the way that they're built and some of the roles and the different things they use inside of there to actually try to emulate the VIX. So you want to probably, at this point, especially with the pricing as cheap as it is, go to the pure play and go right after the VIX options. Now in other news, Tim Geithner is going to be stepping down, and it looks like he'll be doing so before the budget negotiations resume with regard to the next round of negotiations. And this is going to be interesting because he is usually one of the players that comes in. We call him the kneecapper. He usually comes in sometime towards the end to kind of settle some minds and to put some senses back into the individuals that are doing the fighting the most. We've seen him kind of around the world get entered into much of the fray when it comes to these kind of dilemmas where there's a bit of a logjam. I don't know what he actually does and the power this guy has, but man, he must do some serious whispering and winking, because when he comes out of the meeting, usually what happens is within days, there's a major announcement of some sort that clears things up pretty well. Now, whether they're real announcements or whether they're just some kind of rhetoric, you know, we've seen the situation in Europe, for example, you know, that big announcement by Monti, how long ago was that now? 6 months, a year ago? Well, there's been a few of them. But we saw this big announcement, they're going to stand behind things, and we saw some of the best performing bonds in the world of Italy and Greece over the last year. They haven't bought any bonds yet. They haven't really stepped in. So there's a big mouthpiece saying they're going to stand behind it and they're going to do everything they can. They will buy bonds if they need to. They will step into the markets. They will defend the currency, defend the euro, defend the whole thing till the death do they part. And they didn't have to actually do anything. It was just the notion that they were there and they would stand behind it that just ramped everything higher and spooked all the shorts. All the people that were worried about buying said, you know what, there's no worry anymore. They're going to stand behind it. And here we go. Let's go have a party at these depressed prices. Well, again, we saw that Geithner was kind of part of that whole situation, at least from some of the sidelines. So he's going to be retiring, or at least retiring from this position, probably going to work at Goldman or some other major firm or some lobby group over in Washington. And the question is going to be, who's going to replace him? Is it going to be Jamie Dimon? Well, he said no already. Is it going to be Jack Lew, the White House chief of staff? Probably that's the one that's the forerunner right now for this position. But they're going to really need somebody that's going to be able to kick some butt. I'll tell you something. They're going to need somebody who kind of walks quietly like Geithner, but carries a very big stick. Because the next round of this, where they're going to be really dueling over the debt ceiling and using that to hold that hostage for some cuts in spending, is going to be a doozy. And I think it's going to make this last fiscal cliff go around look, rather benign. Now, what we're going to find is whether or not there's going to be some announcements by Moody's and Standard & Poor's and whether or not they're going to chime in here soon and say, you know, whether or not any kind of the wrangling over the next level of the spending and whether they, you know, kind of step in and say, you know, this may or may not have an effect on the credit rating of the U.S. But so far, they've kind of stepped back and said, you know what, we're not going to really do much here because we think that, you know, the situation in the U.S. is rather stable. That could change. That could change depending on what happens with the debt levels. Because that's really what they're looking for is the sustainability of the and the ability for the U.S. to pay their debt. And as that goes up or there's less income tax receipts, that's where the problem comes in with that debt repayment. Already we have the debt ceiling is, what, $16.5 trillion? We hit it recently and it threatens to shut down the government again and big layoffs. You know, the same shenanigans and hoo-ha we've heard over the last, I don't know, how long is it? I guess the last 20 years. But really gotten much more attention now that the numbers have exploded to such a level. You know, we've added somewhere in the neighborhood about $7 or $8 trillion of debt, trillion dollars of debt over the last several years. And that's still a big question of, you know, what that really means to the outlook for the U.S. over time and how do we actually repay that. What's also fascinating to note, I think, lately is that healthcare costs in terms of insurance premiums have been going up dramatically across the country. As a matter of fact, that I think that was Humana at the end of last week came out with an announcement that they are upping their estimates for earnings from their Medicare supplement insurance, which means that I think one of two things. First, maybe they have some more people that are on the plan, but the second thing is that they're more profitable, and that usually comes because they've cut down the cost of some of their reimbursements to doctors, and they've raised their fees. What's really interesting about this and the cost of healthcare in the United States is you got to just wonder and scratch your head for a second and say, wait a minute, I thought this whole Obamacare thing was supposed to, you know, help us cut down on costs somehow and make it much more affordable. Wasn't that the whole platform that the thing was written on, talked about, and promised to us? If your healthcare costs went down, write me. I want to hear about it. Now, that's not just because you went to work for a company and simply because now all of a sudden that company has a different plan. I'm talking about if your healthcare costs, you know, for an individual program, whether it's a Medicare supplement, whether it's an individual plan for you, that you have at your own company or that you own individually, I want to know if it's gone down because I just don't see it. I don't see healthcare costs going down anywhere. We see the pharmacies making more money than they ever made. We're seeing the record company's doing very well. The healthcare record keeping company's doing very well. We're seeing the hospitals do well. We're seeing all across the board, actually, the entire healthcare industry is one of the best performers. Biotech's doing better. The FDA is scaling back some of the requirements. I mean, there's a whole bunch of things that are going on that, you know, make healthcare a great choice for investing. And at the same time, you have to think, is that really what should be happening? it's kind of opposite of what you would think and what seems to be the intelligent choice on this, because, again, it was all slated to be something that would be a cost savings for us, not a wealth builder for the companies that are involved in the sector. But it is what it is. Let's see. What else do I want to talk about here? Ah, banks. Okay, so J.P. Morgan and Citi's going to try again. They were declined last time, but a few of the banks are actually lobbying to see if they can increase their dividends. Really interesting. Now, the banks are under the scrutiny of the Fed, and they have to actually apply for permission to increase the payouts and shareholder payouts because they have the various capital rules, and I guess they can't be trusted, is what it tells me. And the Fed is the one that will approve or disapprove dependent on a variety of different stress tests that they put on the banks. And right now, one of the few that, and there's a few of them, but that could not give out payouts to shareholders are, for example, Citigroup. They were declined last year, but they're coming back to request again. And J.P. Morgan is coming to request an increase, which behind the scenes, the murmurs and the thoughts about when the bank does that is, hey, wait a minute. Banks are much stronger lately, and they're able to give back money to the shareholders. Hey, how great is that? I think that's great. That's a good thing. That's what's keeping the banks doing very well lately, and the stocks of the banks have been doing well. You know what, though? I'm just saying. How about you cut down on maybe some of the costs that are associated with banking just a tad, just a wee little bit? If we're making so much money at the banks and we poured so much money in them to help revive them, sure, the shareholders should be supported and should benefit. No question about that. I mean, it is a business. At the end of the day, it is a business. Let's not lose sight of that. The way it is structured today, whether or not you like it or not, it is a business. At the same time, it is also a utility. And that's why they are they are regulated so closely by an agency of the government. So right now, I think that, you know, that's great that they're able to give back money, but I just think that maybe there should be some discussion also about trimming back some of the exorbitant fees on their ATMs and a variety of other of the fees they charge on checking now, and maybe some of the lack of any interest they're paying on their time deposits. Just a thought. All right, now, I guess we have to talk about this because this is one of those things that is making the rounds very quickly. It's kind of drawing more attention than the Gangnam Style video, it seems, and everybody's kind of getting into a bit of a lather about this. The media is really all over this, the business media, that is, and you kind of wonder where this idea came from and where it's going. Now, if you're not figuring out what I'm talking about yet, it's this whole idea of this $1 trillion coin. Have you heard about this? The idea is vaguely something like this, that the Treasury Department has the ability to print platinum coins in any denomination that they have, blah, 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 blah. At least this is a idea that's been circling around. And what they would do is they would print one, or mint one, $1 trillion coin, put it on deposit with the Fed, and the Fed will then be able to maybe buy some things, give them money, and then that money can be used to pay off some of their debt. It's kind of a, you know, left pocket to right pocket to left pocket kind of deal. And this idea is one that is attempting, at least the concept here, is an attempt to actually do an end run around the debt ceiling. Because by doing this, it gives the government more cash to work with. And in the event that they don't have the agreement on the debt ceiling, they'll be able to actually go out and have $1 trillion to spend because they have it on deposit over here. So the backing of it is, you know, ready cash used, so they don't have to shut down the government. They don't have to worry about all of this, all these last minute negotiations about running out of money. And this, again, is something that's making the rounds, and it's quite preposterous. Will it be done? I don't know. I mean, $1 trillion coin is all you have to do. Does that actually take money out of the system, or does it put money in the system? Is it inflationary, or is it, you know, criminal? There's so many questions that arise from this, because you have to wonder really what the net effect of this is. Essentially, it's putting money back in the system and not paying for it again, so it's just more debt in some way. it's on the books of the Fed, so it's really off balance sheet. Really, that's what the Fed is. It's an off balance sheet deal of the government, which, of course, companies are not allowed to really do anymore. But the government is, because they're the government. Now, if they do such a thing, it will give them, the people who want to move ahead with the debt ceiling talks and not do anything about spending, any of the people that are involved in that, any of the politicians that have that mindset, it will give them greater leverage and tilt it from where the Republicans are going to try to stop any legislation to try to increase the debt ceiling before there's any meaningful spending cuts. So that's kind of why this is coming around now. It's kind of an ace in the hole by the other side that is trying to move ahead without any spending reform at all. And they're doing it in such a way that is going to allow them to essentially, kind of, again, off-balance sheet budget for this deal. So I don't know. I mean, is it something that's interesting? It's interesting and to talk about. Is it realistic? I just don't think it's realistic. If they do it, it's really going to get a little ugly. There's going to have a lot of people up in arms about this, because really, where's the end of this? Why not just print two coins? Why not just print a $100 trillion coin? You know, just be done with it. Why print one? Just go print a $100 trillion coin. If you could figure out how many zeros that is and how to fit that somehow. You may have to do an arc of some sort, right? You can't just write across, maybe, because you need a big coin. So if you want to have the coin a reasonable size, maybe the size of a silver dollar, maybe a little bit bigger, you'd have to probably arc it. The numbers, because there's so many zeros there. Or maybe just write it out and don't even put the number there, because, or maybe just you know what? I got it. Just put the number, maybe a million, and then simply put a factor on top of it, and that will just quantify it right there. Interesting. Now, if that gets into the wrong hands, how cool will that be? I mean, think about, people want to steal the Mona Lisa, they want to steal the Hope Diamond. Wow, the $10 trillion or $100 trillion coin. How great would that be? Although I don't know what you do with it. Probably can't pawn it. Probably can't figure any way to break it down. It's made out of platinum. It's not worth as much as the face amount. But it'd be a great collector's item. Who knows? May have a lot of them one day that we can collect. Especially if they go down that route. Oh, it's very frustrating. Very frustrating. So where do I think earnings season is going to go? That's a question that has been asked to me a few times. Another question, by the way, that has been asked to me is what are my favorite sites to get information from? I'm going to try to put that in a show in the next 2 weeks. Some of the sites that I use, some of the newspapers that I read, some of the areas I go for news. I have about a dozen or two that I bring up every so often and get out to you, and some things that you need to look into, because there's some places that you can actually use for news, and some things you just want to throw away. Some places you can use for research, some places you just don't want to. Some places you can use for quotes, and some places that are, just off. Because don't forget, this is very important, that you may be looking at something online and it's free, and you say, oh, well, the closing price of this and the volume of that, and you put into your calculations and it makes sense, and you look at the 50-day moving average and all this stuff, and you use that for your investing. What if I was to tell you that different sites and different programs, different data sources, use different mechanisms for pricing a stock? Now, I know that sounds ludicrous, but think about it. If you've never thought about it before, some places, stock charts may do a different calculation of inclusion of dividends in their calculation of the actual price of the stock. They may say, wait a minute, Apple closes at 525, it's 525 everywhere, right? Well, yes and no. If you're going to, Apple maybe, but another stock that has a dividend adjustment may have a different price history over time. And by using it or not using it changes your various averages and all the calculations that go into any historical measure of where the stock has been and what the actual indicator that you're using will show. So where the price may actually close at a certain value, the moving average may be different from place to place. So if you're betting on the 50-day moving average and saying, hey, cross that or on the upside or downside, and looking to that as an investment mechanism to actually go long or short, well, what if I was to tell you that it's different on different platforms? And what you should be using is the one that most professionals use and most institutional investors use, because that's the one that they're going to be using and where you really should be focusing your attention on. So know the data that you're using, because data in, garbage data is just going to give you really bad Yeah, you can get lucky. You can be close. But I think if you're relying on data, first of all, consistency is important. But I think secondly, you know, reliability of accurate data is just as important, if not more important. So consistency of data and accuracy of data. And I'll go through some of that in a couple of weeks. We'll put together something and share with you the places I would go, maybe some of the settings, and et cetera. I think I'm going to do a poll also of where everybody uses and what their favorite platforms are and service providers, and whether it's Fidelity or Thinkorswim or Interactive Brokers or TradeStation or whatever else it is. I'd like to know kind of what you have. I'll put that together. I got that on my list somewhere. We'll put that together this week over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com so you can check it out and you can tell me what's going on so I can maybe give you a little line. And by the way, if you have a question about a provider, a website that you use, or one that you think is just really great that you want me to bring up, please send it in. Just send it to askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The other thing I'll note, I've noted this before, but the commodity alerts is up and running. If you've been wanting to trade commodities, whether it's oil or the S&P futures or bonds or corn or wheat, whatever it may be, the commodity alerts from Trigger Point Research is up and running. Get yourself a two-week trial for free, absolutely for free. Just go over to triggerpointresearch.com/subscribe, and you can get yourself a two-week trial to that or the equity alerts. And both of those programs have been pumping out some really great long-term data and some great performance. That is available on the site as well. You can see what's going on with some of that. And when you get your two-week trial, you'll be able to actually log in and get some of the details on that. And you don't have to put up a credit card. You don't have to worry about that. There's no, you know, no requirements at all. Freebie, two-week trial. But you have to sign up. You have to kind of do it if you want to check it out. And you get the full privileges of a full package. It's worth about $179 a month for the full package. So you could check that out and do it for... So I'm pretty much giving you 80-something bucks a month to do this, or, you know, for the two-week period. It's pretty good. And if you actually take both programs for 2 weeks, you're saving yourself about 150 bucks or so, plus or minus. So take me up on that offer and check it out. I really encourage you to do so. If nothing else, give you a couple ideas here and there that may be very beneficial. Otherwise, you can also check out thedisciplinedinvestor.com for how we manage money. And if you're looking for us to manage your money, it's on there. If you like the ideas that we talk about, do that. The other thing I'll mention, if you haven't noticed yet, that each and every day we have a video. We have a commodities video that focuses in on TAS, professional research tools, and teaches you how and when, and, you know, some of the ideas on when to trade commodities. It covers just a whole, just an assortment of things. There's some really cool indicators there that I've been helping, and we've been helping actually build, and some of the things that you really need to learn about when it comes to what we call boxes or iRatio or the Navigator. There's a whole bunch of them that you really should be looking at. So check that out each and every day on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and you can actually sign up to get a daily email so you can see what's going on there as well. Well, that's going to do it for me for today, keeping it short and sweet, because we do have a lot of earnings that I'm going to review next week and come to you with that. And in the meantime, like I said, any questions you have, just email to me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and we'll be sure to answer them. And head on over to triggerpointresearch.com as well for your 14-day free trial. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you again next week on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Be well. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented that should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.